Maneuvering, thus, requires planning, but also improvisation. Small triumphs in a single arena set up larger ones elsewhere, allowing weaker contenders to become stronger. And that brings us back to the young Octavian running circles around the befuddled Antony, leveraging limited assets until he could switch at Actium to a more direct approach. 10. We have come a great long way, a poet told Octavian shortly after his return from Alexandria in the year 29. The time has come to unyoke our steaming horses. The poet was Virgil, the poem was the Georgics, and Octavian is said to have listened as the author and a few friends read it aloud over several days, all 2,118 hexameters. This was no epic. The Aeneid would come later, and the occasion has so puzzled Octavian's recent biographers that they've passed over it. Why would the most powerful man in the world sit still for instruction at such length on the rotation of crops, the nurturing of vines, the breeding of cattle, and the keeping of bees? John Buchan, an earlier biographer, suggested that Octavian was ready to slow down, to look around, and to think about how to use power, now that he had no rivals. He was shifting from navigation to cultivation. The rising Octavian had spent a decade and a half fending off, buying out, circumventing, eliminating, or capitalizing on threats posed by Antony, Cicero, Cassius, Brutus, Fulvia, Lucius, Sextus, Lepidus, Cleopatra, and Caesarion, as well as Rome's Senate, its mobs, his sicknesses, storms and shipwrecks, even a comet. He did so resourcefully, but he wasn't setting the pace. He kept seizing the initiative, losing it, and having to regain it. He couldn't keep this up. No steaming horse runs forever. After Actium, Octavian began controlling events, rather than letting them control him. He put off any new campaign against the Parthians. He placed local rulers, Herod in Judea was an example, in charge of difficult provinces. He settled veterans by giving them land and long-term support. He pleased Rome by accepting triumphs, staging games, and starting a building program meant to match Alexandria's. But knowing the dangers of arrogance, he also affected modesty. He rushed through his triumphs instead of stretching them out, maintained less than luxurious living arrangements, and when returning from travel, crept into the city to avoid elaborate welcomes. He secured authority by appearing to renounce it, most dramatically on the first day of 27 when he unexpectedly gave up all his responsibilities. The surprised Senate had no choice but to forbid this and to award Octavian the title of Princeps, first citizen, as well as a new name, Augustus. What he was really doing was giving up the Republic, but so gradually and with such tact, while displaying at every stage such self-evident benefits, that the Romans would adapt to and even embrace their new environment, hardly noticing how much it had changed. They themselves would become crops, vines, cattle, and bees. For unlike Xerxes, Pericles, Alexander, and Julius Caesar, not the least of whose gifts to Octavian had been to start him early, Caesar Augustus saw time as an ally. As the historian Mary Beard has pointed out, he didn't need to abolish anything. He used time to grow things. One was a constitutional settlement renewing respect for the Senate and the rule of law, while retaining, as if in a soft glove, an iron fist. Another was imperial stabilization. The empire, Augustus announced, was large enough. Beyond a few boundary adjustments, it needn't expand further. Still another was a national epic. Rome had no Homer, so the Princeps provided one. The Aeneid, unlike the Iliad and the Odyssey, is a commissioned work. Augustus encouraged its composition, subsidized its author, and saved the manuscript from the flames when the dissatisfied Virgil, on his deathbed, asked to have it burned. Aeneas is a prince of Troy who, after fleeing those flames and surviving countless tests, founds Rome, a city that becomes an empire favored by gods. He could be Octavian on his path to power, his thoughts racing here, there, probing his options, shifting to this plan, that, as quick as flickering light. But apart from a famous prophecy, son of a god, he will bring back the age of gold, Virgil says little about how Augustus might use power. The Aeneid looks to Rome's past, not its future. It celebrates navigation, not cultivation. Why, then, did the princeps see such value in planting and preserving this very long poem? The greatness of poetic perception, the novelist Hermann Brock has him say to the dying poet, and therefore your greatness, Virgil, lies in being able to grasp all of life in a single survey, in a single work, in a single glance. So are strategy and statecraft the ability to grasp interconnections? To know where you've been in order to see where you're going? It's hard to understand otherwise how an indirect approach, whether Odysseus twists and turns or Octavian's probes and shifts, can ever reach Ithaca or anywhere else. It will yet be part of my future fame, Brock's Augustus correctly concludes, that I was the friend of Virgil. 11. There were some things, though, that even Augustus couldn't control. One, sadly, was his own family. He understood, as had his great uncle, that abandoning the Republic would subject the empire to the uncertainties of inheritance. It seemed a reasonable bargain at the time, for Rome was more tolerant of divorce and adoption than most monarchies would later become. That would allow the cultivation of heirs and opportunities to tether the most promising without having to depend on who'd given birth to whom. Misfortune caught up with Augustus, though, in the breeding, the word isn't too strong, of his own family. He married four times, but only his third wife produced a child, Julia, who for all her brilliance and self-assurance could not, as a woman, succeed him. That left adoption as an alternative, and a major priority for Augustus as princeps was to grow a new Octavian. His first choice was Marcellus, the much-admired son of his sister Octavia by her first marriage. Augustus had him marry Julia when she was only 14. But Marcellus died of a sudden illness at 21, in time for Virgil to portray him poignantly as a lost spirit in the Aeneid. The next possibilities were Tiberius and Drusus, the sons by a previous marriage of Augustus' last and longtime wife, Livia. Drusus died at 29, though, from injuries sustained in a riding accident. Tiberius stayed healthy, but he and the princeps distrusted each other, owing to still more maneuvers on the latter's part to secure a successor. Hoping to expand his options, Augustus forced Julia, after the death of Marcellus, to marry the much older Agrippa, his own contemporary and the genius behind so many of his military victories. They had five children, with three males among them, but Gaius and Lucius died young, and the third, Agrippa Postumus, born after his father's death, became, as a teenager, a vicious thug. So Augustus, now desperate, demanded that Tiberius divorce his wife, whom he loved, and marry Agrippa's widow, whom he hated. Julia reciprocated, and the unhappy union produced only a child who died in infancy, after which Tiberius, defying Augustus, exiled himself to the island of Rhodes. From there, he divorced Julia, whose sexual escapades had begun shocking even the Romans, leading Augustus to exile her to the smaller and more desolate island of Pandateria, off the Italian coast. Hoping for the best, Augustus then adopted Tiberius and Agrippa Postumus in 4 CE and at the age of 67, but with little confidence in either. 5 years later, far too old by the standards of his era to be running anything, the princeps suffered his worst military defeat. He'd long opposed expanding the empire, but this didn't preclude straightening its perimeters. He therefore approved an extension of Roman rule from the Rhine to the Elbe, which would, with the Danube, shorten the mostly riverine boundary running from the north to the Black Sea. It looked good on maps, but it required pacifying Germania, a heavily forested region of which the Romans knew little. The task fell to Publius Quinctilius Varus, who promptly led 3 legions at Teutoburg into a catastrophic ambush. Some 15,000 men were enslaved or killed, surviving relics suggest by particularly gruesome means, and Augustus lost a tenth of his entire army almost overnight. He's said to have raged for months, banging his head against walls, talking to himself, refusing to shave, seeing no one. Lear-like, but without a heath, a storm, or the consolations of a fool. He eventually pulled himself together, knowing, though, that, despite his long life, he'd secured neither his empire nor his succession. The best he could manage, when he knew he was dying, was to surprise Agrippa Postumus on the island to which he'd been exiled and, after determining that the young man hadn't changed, to have him slain with no greater regret than Octavian had felt for Caesarion almost half a century earlier. The embittered Tiberius, it was now understood, would become, untethered, the new Caesar. Augustus died, just short of his 77th birthday, in the same house in which his real father had done so, near Naples. The date was August 19th, 14. Characteristically, he'd prepared last words. "I found Rome built of clay. I leave it to you in marble." But then he asked, with a lightness that, for all his troubles, never quite left him, "Have I played my part in the farce of life creditably enough?" And then he added, as if Shakespeare had staged his curtain call, "If I have pleased you, kindly signify appreciation with a warm goodbye." In his great novel On the Life of Augustus, John Williams has Julia recall asking her father, when they were still speaking, "Has it been worth it? This Rome that you have saved, this Rome that you have built? Has it been worth all that you have had to do?" The princeps looks at her for a long time and then looks away. "I must believe that it has," he finally replies. "We both must believe that it has." 12. Perhaps it was. Rome's subsequent history set standards unsurpassed since for dysfunctional ruling families and exposed imperial perimeters. Still, by the strictest reckoning, the empire survived for 4.5 centuries after Augustus' death. Rome didn't fall until 476. The Byzantine Empire, founded by Constantine, would last for another 1,000 years. And his role in Christianizing the Roman Empire would be at least as consequential as that of Augustus in establishing it. The Holy Roman Empire, a European remnant of Roman rule, originated in 800 with Charlemagne, one of whose titles was Most Serene Augustus, and held itself together for its own 1,000 years, until Napoleon swept it aside. Even he knew better than to try that with the Roman Catholic Church, founded in the age of Augustus, which seems likely to endure for as far into our future as anyone can foresee, under the rule of a Pontifex Maximus, a position dating back to the ancient kings of Rome some 6 centuries before Octavian was born. Longevity, for empires, is by no means automatic. Most have risen, fallen, and been forgotten. Others may be remembered for the legends they inspired, the arts they produced, or the ruins they left behind, but not for much else. Who today would model a state on Xerxes' Persia, or Pericles' Athens, or Alexander's Macedonia? Rome, though, is different, as is China. Their legacies, in language, religious belief, political institutions, legal principles, technological innovation, and imperial administration, have survived repeated collapses of regimes that gave rise to them. If the post-Cold War era is indeed to witness a contest between the West and the East, then that will reflect the durability of Roman and Chinese cultures, empires of mind cultivated through many crises over a very long time. Augustus was Rome's most skillful cultivator. Having navigated himself into unchallenged authority, he used it to turn a failing republic, as if it were a Virgilian vine, into an empire that flourishes in more ways than most of us realize even now. Plants aren't aware that they're being made to mature in a certain way, but if firmly rooted and carefully tended, they'll cooperate. The princeps was fortunate to have been given the time such horticulture requires. He employed it productively while cultivating within himself a purpose for planting as well as, in harvesting, self-restraint. He feared, at the end, that he'd failed, and in one sense he had. He never got to train a successor in the way Julius Caesar had trained him. Had the dying Augustus foreseen his heir's abuses, he'd have been horrified. Nero was only 40 years into the future. But Rome was robust enough, as China has also been, to survive terrifyingly bad rulers. Both have done so through diversification. Dependent on no single variety of power, they grew into ecosystems, as robust gardens and forests tend to do. It's all the more interesting, then, that Augustus understood so much of Sun Tzu while knowing nothing of him. The explanation may lie in a logic of strategy that undergirds cultures, much as grammar does languages, over vast stretches of time, space, and scale. If so, common sense, when confronting uncommon circumstances, may itself be another of the contradictions held simultaneously in the minds of first-rate intelligences. For the practice of principles must precede their derivation, articulation, and institutionalization. You may be looking at clouds, like Polonius, but you'll need to have both feet firmly planted on the ground. Chapter 4. Souls and States. Shortly after the Civil War ended, a young American spent two arduous years among the peoples of northeastern Siberia. He was George Kennan, the distant relative of a better-known 20th century namesake, George F. Kennan, who would devise the Cold War strategy of containment. The first Kennan, 20 at the time, was surveying routes for a telegraph that would link the United States with Europe. Underwater cables were as yet unreliable, so the possibility of a landline through British Columbia, Russian Alaska, Siberia, and European Russia, requiring only a crossing of the Bering Strait, seemed worth exploring. The project collapsed when, in 1866, the Atlantic cable at last started working, but it took Kennan months to get the word. He wound up without a future in long-distance telegraphy and with a personal religious crisis. In his 1870 book, Tent Life in Siberia, Kennan admitted how easily he might have slipped from the Ohio Presbyterianism in which he'd been raised into the worship of evil spirits who are supposed to be embodied in all the mysterious powers and manifestations of nature, such as epidemic and contagious diseases, severe storms, famines, eclipses, and brilliant auroras. Christianity in adversity was surprisingly shallow. No one who has ever lived with the Siberian natives, studied their character, subjected himself to the same influences that surround them, and put himself as far as possible in their places, will ever doubt the sincerity of either priests or followers, or wonder that the worship of evil spirits should be their only religion. It is the only religion possible for such men in such circumstances. Even Russians, steeped in orthodoxy and with long experience in the region, could find their God distant and malevolent forces near. They sacrificed a dog, like very pagans, to propitiate the diabolical wrath of which the storm was an evidence. The actions of man, Kennan concluded, are governed not so much by what he intellectually believes as by what he vividly realizes. This fear of what's beyond understanding roots religion in all the great cultures of which we know. Atheism has little historical continuity. But as long as religions were polytheistic, when each calamity was the caprice of a particular god, faiths posed few problems for the running of states. Gods spent so much time quarreling with one another that mortals maintained a kind of balance among them. Men could respect or neglect gods, even on occasion make or unmake them, an art at which the Romans especially excelled. No single set of beliefs challenged official authority. Except among Jews, for whom feuds among gods were the ambivalences of a single god, who'd complicated things further by choosing them to form a state. The history of Israel became a jagged disputation between this deity, acting through angels and prophets, and his designees, reacting as kings, priests, and even in one instance, an old man scraping scabs on an ash heap. But as Edward Gibbon, the first great modern historian of Rome, pointed out, Judaism was an exclusionary religion. Having been chosen, Jews sought few converts, so their state never had the imperial aspirations of Rome's empire. Augustus could govern it, as he did Gaul, Spain, or Pannonia, without fearing that he was raising a rival. The princeps couldn't have known that another monotheism, this one inclusionary, had appeared during his reign. A pure and humble religion, Gibbon wrote, that gently insinuated itself into the minds of men, grew up in silence and obscurity, derived new vigor from opposition, and finally erected the triumphant banner of the cross on the ruins of the Capitol. Covering himself carefully, Gibbon attributed Christianity's rise to its proselytizing zeal, its flexibility about ritual, its claims of miracles, its promise of an afterlife, and, of course, the convincing evidence of the doctrine itself, and the ruling providence of its great author. It would take centuries, but this empire would be the first to flourish, as Rome's never did, on a global scale. Not, however, without a recurring dilemma. What did its subjects owe to Caesar, and what to God? Could Christianity survive in the absence of state protection? Could the state claim legitimacy without Christianity's sanction? Resolving these issues would consume the attention of medieval and early modern minds. Nor is it clear, even now, whether Christianity caused Rome's fall, as Gibbon believed, or, as the legacies of Augustus suggest, secured Rome's institutional immortalities. These opposites have shaped Western civilization ever since. Not least by giving rise to two truly grand strategies, parallel in their purposes, but devised 1,000 years apart by, as we've come to think of them, one of the greatest of saints and one of the gravest of sinners. 1. Augustine never regarded himself as a saint. Born in 354 CE in the small North African town of Thagaste, he's notorious within the annals of autobiography, a genre he largely invented, for portraying himself, even at his mother's breast, as a ravenous parasite. If babies are innocent, it is not for lack of will to do harm, but for lack of strength. He grew up not learning Greek because forced to try, enthralled with the Aeneid, but not arithmetic, weeping for Dido, but not God. He wasted time cheating at games. He failed to worry about worrying his parents. He sought pleasure, beauty, and truth only in worldly things. I was a great sinner for so small a boy. And that was before he, as a teenager, discovered sex. I was inflamed with desire. I ran wild with lust. I was foul to the core. Yet I was pleased with my own condition. So tell us more, readers throughout the ages have furtively whispered. So he does. Adolescent sex welling within me exuded mists which clouded over and obscured my heart. Love and lust together seethed within me. I was tossed and spilled, floundering in the broiling sea of my fornication. One day at the public baths, my father saw the signs of active virility coming to life in me, and was happy to tell my mother about it, for enough already. But Augustine, unembarrassed, plows on. He devotes pages of his Confessions to a single pear tree, from which he and his gang knocked off all the fruit, sour anyway, and fed it to pigs. For the sake of a laugh, a little sport, I was glad to do harm, because we are ashamed to hold back when others say, "Come on, let's do it." It's the second most famous fruit-bearing tree in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and Augustine uses it and much else in this strange work, Why Publish a Confession Made Privately to God, to ask how an omnipotent deity can, within the world he created, allow imperfections of any kind. Jupiter punishes the wicked with his thunderbolts, and yet commits adultery himself, Augustine impertinently points out. The two roles are quite incompatible. Where, though, does that leave Christianity's God? The question was urgent for Augustine's age, because the Emperor Constantine had legalized all religions in 313, an improbable miracle, it seemed, when Christians had so recently suffered Diocletian's persecutions. But Rome's fortunes, even with Christianity as its official religion, had hardly improved. Imperial succession remained unpredictable. Boundaries were overstretched and underdefended. Barbarians, no better understood than Kenan Siberians, crashed against outposts in waves from the fathomless reaches of Asia. Visigoths sacked Rome itself in 410, when Augustine was 56, and two decades later he would die, besieged literally by Vandals in the North African port of Hippo Regis, where he'd long been bishop. Augustine wrote the Confessions soon after taking that position, for which he thought himself ill-prepared. He'd spent most of his 20s as a Manichaean, seeking to explain evil by limiting God's power. This at last proved too simple, and under the influence of a formidable mother, Monica, and an imposing mentor, Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, Augustine underwent a slow and painful conversion to Christianity, which he describes vividly. Even then, he hoped only to establish a monastery until the Christians in Hippo, where he wanted to put it, forcibly ordained him as a priest, and then promoted him to episcopal status. It seems an odd way of proceeding, recruiting bishops as draft choices, like professional athletes, but it reflected a desperate search for authority as Roman rule was receding. Bishops provided spiritual guidance while also serving as magistrates, law enforcers, and community organizers. Theological training was less important than firmness of will, persuasiveness in rhetoric, and the pragmatism necessary to get things done. The mature Augustine possessed these qualities, but he had something else his flock couldn't have anticipated: the capacity to make the most of an opportunity. From this perch he hadn't chosen on the periphery of a crumbling Roman world, Augustine set out to reconcile faith with reason in worlds to come. The Confessions began the journey with a self-imposed public humiliation, leaving all the more room for his subsequent work to soar. 2. The City of God, Augustine's magnum opus, composed over many years and completed shortly before his death, isn't about differences between heaven and earth, as is often supposed, but rather overlapping terrestrial jurisdictions. To oversimplify vastly, there is one God, and there can be only one Caesar. Men owe allegiance to both while on earth. How they balance these loyalties determines prospects for eternal life. But the demands of Caesar and the judgments of God reflect circumstances as well as certainties. The unexpected may not surprise God. Augustine has the humility to be unsure. It cannot, though, be anticipated by man. Man, therefore, must manage unknowns, for God has endowed him, or cursed him, with free will. That's the price paid for original sin, but it's also the opportunity that allows hope. Human existence need not be pointless. Man isn't at the mercy of capricious gods. Determining obligations to Caesar and God becomes, then, the grandest of strategic tasks, for it requires aligning limited human capabilities with an aspiration, an afterlife, that has no limits. Unfortunately, City lacks the clarity of the Confessions. It's a loose, baggy literary leviathan, a Moby Dick of theology, in which cycles and epicycles, angels and demons, myths and histories jostle one another in no particular order. Making it a manual for strategy, much less for salvation, is devilishly difficult. Strangely, though, miraculously almost, Augustine benefits from being taken out of context. You can pull together topics from where he's left them, free them from the qualifications and digressions with which he's surrounded them, and they'll usually make sense. His style obscures inner logic, nowhere more so than on the issue of war and peace. When is a Christian justified in not turning the other cheek, but in fighting and, if necessary, killing? What obligations can a Christian ruler impose in defense of his rule on those he rules? How, if at all, might a state be saved without endangering souls? Why bother if, as Augustine maintains, Caesar's world is corrupt and God's is perfect? And what, in Augustine's answers, themselves imperfect, as he acknowledges, has made them soar, influencing thinking on just war ever since? 3. The genius of Augustine is that he concerns himself more with tensions than with their sources. Order versus justice, war versus peace, Caesar versus God. He treats polarities as gravitational forces without trying to say what gravity is. Man's choices lie between the polarities, but no formulae reveal what those choices should be. For every thou shalt not kill, Augustine finds commendations within sacred texts of opposite behavior. He questions authorial intent centuries before post-structuralism. He's comfortable, up to a point, with contradictions. That makes his teachings procedural, not absolute. While respecting the Neoplatonism that influenced early Christianity, Augustine shows that reality always falls short of the ideal. One can strive toward it, but never expect to achieve it. Seeking, therefore, is the best man can manage in a fallen world, and what he seeks is his choice. Nevertheless, not all ends are legitimate, not all means are appropriate. Augustine seeks, therefore, to guide choice by respecting choice. He does this through an appeal to reason, one might even say to common sense. Take, for example, the question of why states are necessary. If God is all-powerful, who needs Caesars? Without Caesars, Augustine replies, there'd be no Christians, and that can't be God's will. To be a Christian is itself to choose, freely, to follow Christ. But that choice would have left little behind if all Christians had been fed to lions. Caesars rarely did that, however, The Roman Empire over the 3 centuries from Jesus' death to Constantine's was, despite repressive intervals, a surprisingly hospitable space for the new religion. Which is one of the reasons Augustine and his fellow Christians found the 4th and 5th century decline of Rome so unnerving. It followed, then, as a generalization derived from observation, that order must precede justice, for what rights can exist under constant terror? A peaceful faith, the only source of justice for Christians, can't flourish without protection, whether through toleration, as in pre-Constantine Rome, or by formal edict, as afterward. The city of God is a fragile structure within the sinful city of man. It's this that leads Christians to entrust authority to selected sinners. We call it politics. And Augustine, for all his piety, is a political philosopher. Just as he also became, as Rome's authority waned, an authoritarian bishop, prepared to embrace lesser evils, or, as he put it, benevolent harshness, in order to ward off greater ones. Augustine's targets were deviations from orthodoxy, which he attacked with an almost Leninist zeal, as if the only way to advance a faith is to purge it of all nuance. His mind was larger than his persecutions, however. The implications of his thinking were more sweeping, more lasting, and ultimately more humane. Augustine concluded that war, if necessary to save the state, could be a lesser evil than peace, and that the procedural prerequisites for necessity could be stated. Had provocation occurred? Had competent authority exhausted peaceful alternatives? Would the resort to violence be a means chosen, not an end in itself? Was the expenditure of force proportionate to its purposes, so that it wouldn't destroy what it was meant to defend? Could these human decisions, for Augustine never doubted that they were that, advance some divine purpose? So that cities of God and man could coexist without fracturing a flawed world? 4. There were, of course, precedents for questioning the wisdom of war. Artabanus, Archidamus, and Nicias had all done that, if unsuccessfully, and Thucydides' doomed Melians had raised timeless misgivings about the conduct of wars once started. No one before Augustine, however, had set standards to be met by states in choosing war. This could be done only within an inclusionary monotheism, for only a god claiming universal authority could judge the souls of earthly rulers. And only Augustine, in his era, spoke so self-confidently for him. The cringing author of the Confessions had come a long way. Augustine framed his standards as a checklist, not as commandments. He knew how often prophets had thundered prohibitions, only to reverse them in the face of necessity or new instructions from on high. For all of his harshness in rooting out heretics, Augustine preferred persuasion on issues of war and peace. Have you thought about this? Or wouldn't it make sense to do that? He saw no need, within this realm, to threaten, and that gained him followers over time. That's because checklists adapt better to change than commandments. Sailors rely on them before going to sea. Soldiers employ them in planning missions. Surgeons demand them to make sure they'll have the instruments they need and that they'll leave none behind. Pilots run through them to ensure taking off safely and landing smoothly, preferably at the intended airport. Parents deploy them against all that can go wrong in transporting small children. Checklists pose common questions in situations that may surprise. The idea is to approach these having, as much as possible, reduced the likelihood that they will. Augustine's great uncertainty was the status of souls in the city of man, for only the fittest could hope to enter the city of God. Pre-Christian deities had rarely made such distinctions. The pagan afterlife was equally grim for heroes, scoundrels, and all in between. Not so, though, with a Christian God. Behavior in life would make a huge difference in death. It was vital, then, to fight wars within rules. The stakes could hardly be higher. 5. There were problems, however, with Augustine's checklists. If the need to fight wars by rules was so great, why did he squirrel away so much of what he wrote on that subject in the manner of that creature? So that it took centuries for others, Aquinas, Gratian, Grotius, Luther, Calvin, Locke, Kant, to locate, excavate, codify, and apply Augustine's insights to the realm of statecraft. How could he hope to save states or souls by hiding the means of doing so? The Confessions had shown Augustine to be capable of luminous clarity, as had the thousands of sermons he delivered as a working bishop, many of which we can still sample. But maybe that was the difficulty. Augustine had heavy episcopal responsibilities throughout the last half of his career. These entitled him to scribes who relied on shorthand to record his ideas, but that in turn imposed the burden of volume, for who had the time to go through it all, organize it, and make it readable? Augustine's pronouncements, like Nixon's tapes, swamped their originator. So while Augustine's checklists would influence thinking about war for hundreds of years to come, thinkers can take the time to ferret out obscure texts, it's less clear that these moderated the actual conduct of wars to come. Perhaps, though, there's a larger issue that even clear presentation might not have resolved. It's that Augustine was never wholeheartedly a monotheist. He worshipped reason as much as he worshipped God, but he never showed God to be any more bound by reason than Jupiter had been. The two roles are quite incompatible. This is where Augustine was uncomfortable with contradictions. Why do wars happen in the first place? They reflect, of course, man's sinfulness resulting from his fallen state. But because God is all-powerful, wars must also accord with his will, even though Augustine holds that God's actions consistently manifest his love for man. So man must in some way benefit from war, perhaps by being punished, like a child, for his own good, or if dead, transported to a better world. How, though, if this is the case, can some wars be just and some not? Why have standards at all? They illuminate the path, Augustine suggests, by which the righteous within the city of man make their way to the city of God, leaving the unrighteous behind. What, though, distinguishes these qualities? Not pacifism, for Augustine regards military service as necessary to sustain the state without which Christianity can't survive. Nor is such service conditional. Christian soldiers must obey orders, he insists, and can only hope that these will meet the standards of justice. Whether they do or not reflects circumstances that only God can determine. Thus, even unjust wars, if fought for Christ, can become just. Augustine could have been with the Athenians on Melos. He's a theological Dr. Pangloss, seeing in the worst that can happen the best that's possible. Or so it might seem. But perhaps a compromise lies where Augustine's checklists leave you, when you do have room to maneuver. You lean, bend, or tilt in a certain direction when choosing between order and justice, war and peace, Caesar and God. You're aligning aspirations with capabilities. For in Augustine's thinking, justice, peace, and God fit the first category, while order, war, and Caesar inhabit the second. Alignment, in turn, implies interdependence. Justice is unattainable in the absence of order. Peace may require the fighting of wars. Caesar must be propitiated, perhaps even like Constantine, converted, if man is to reach God. Each capability brings an aspiration within reach, much as Sun Tzu's practices tether his principles. But what's the nature of the tether? I think it's proportionality. The means employed must be appropriate to, or at least not corrupt, the end envisaged. This, then, is Augustine's tilt, toward a logic of strategy transcending time, place, culture, circumstance, and the differences between saints and sinners. 6. It's long been assumed that Machiavelli is in hell, and, worse, content to be there. That possibility would not have occurred to Augustine, or to many, if any, of his contemporaries. Hippo Regis and Florence, where Niccolò Machiavelli was born in 1469 and spent most of his life, weren't that far apart geographically. Both had been near peripheries of a much farther-flung Roman Empire. By the late 15th century, though, Rome's situation had greatly changed. Its emperors had become popes managing strikingly different empires. An all-too-worldly city of man confined to the papal states of central Italy and the Roman Catholic Church, a supposedly universal city of God, coexisting uneasily with secular sovereignties throughout central and western Europe, some of which were now extending their rule under the Pope's semi-supervision to the edges of South and Southeast Asia, and to newly discovered lands to be known soon as America. From his office high above the Piazza della Signoria in Florence, the young Machiavelli, a rising functionary in the city-state's government, could have seen celebrations honoring Amerigo Vespucci. The Vespuccis were Florentines, and he knew the family. The first sentence of Machiavelli's Discourses on the First 10 Books of Titus Livius, which he began writing in 1515 after falling from favor, finds it no less dangerous to discover new ways and methods than to set out in search of new seas and unknown lands. This is not, however, because of God's wrath, but human envy. Augustine worried about both. Machiavelli, recently imprisoned and tortured, fears God less than he does man. Not that he disbelieved or was disrespectful. His writings refer often to God, as was customary in the culture from which he came. But the gods of the ancients and the Christian God, Machiavelli slyly suggests, could have been the same. He attends Mass rarely enough to cause comment, even jokes, among his friends. And Machiavelli never takes it upon himself to speak for or to try to explain God, as did Augustine. Except for a single significant sentence in The Prince, the book that's supposed to have sent Machiavelli to hell. God does not want to do everything. It's hard to see why this was controversial, for Machiavelli is careful to add, so as not to take free will from us and that part of the glory that falls to us. Wasn't free will God's idea? Wasn't it supposed to lead to redemption, which would be glorious for those who achieved it? Questions like these, in Augustine's thinking, had run up against his belief in God's omnipotence. How could freedom exist in a predetermined world? Uneasy with these opposites, he tried but failed on an epic scale to reconcile them. Machiavelli, in contrast, is more relaxed. If God said free will, then he must have meant it. Isn't it arrogant to try to constrain him within the limits of reason? Wouldn't it be liberating for man not to try? You might conclude from this, following Isaiah Berlin, that Augustine was a hedgehog and Machiavelli a fox. You might acknowledge, emboldened by F. Scott Fitzgerald, that Machiavelli had a first-rate intelligence, holding opposites in mind while functioning, and that Augustine, for all his diligence, fell short. Neither view seems implausible. But a more revealing distinction may lie in temperament. To borrow from Milan Kundera, Machiavelli found lightness of being bearable. For Augustine, perhaps because traumatized as a youth by a pear tree, it was unendurable. 7. So what is lightness of being? My students would say that it's learning not to sweat it, and Machiavelli, from behind several hedges, uses that very verb. Many have held and hold the opinion that worldly things are so governed by fortune and by God that men cannot correct them with their prudence, indeed that they have no remedy at all. And on account of this, they might judge that one need not sweat much over things, but let oneself be governed by chance. When I have thought about this sometimes, I have been in some part inclined to their opinion. In the end, though, he resists being blown about like a feather. I judge that it might be true that fortune is arbiter of half our actions, but also that she leaves the other half, or close to it, for us to govern. 50% fortune, 50% man, but 0% God. Man is, however precariously, on his own. Machiavelli knows from Florence's experience with the Arno that rivers, when flooding, can cause great destruction. But men, if far-sighted, can lessen the danger by building dikes and dams. God may approve, but no longer himself does hydraulics. States, Machiavelli suggests, operate similarly. If governed badly, men's rapacity will soon overwhelm them, whether through internal rebellion or external war. But if run with vertu, his untranslatable term for planning without praying, states can constrain, if not in all ways control, the workings of fortune or chance. The skills needed are those of imitation, adaptation, and approximation. Machiavelli commends the study of history, for since men almost always walk on paths beaten by others and proceed in their actions by imitation, a prudent man should always enter upon the paths beaten by great men and imitate those who have been most excellent, so that if his own virtue does not reach that far, it is at least in the odor of it. That's adaptation. Machiavelli's odor is Thucydides' distinction between reflection and resemblance, which the passage of time sharpens. And approximation? Prudent archers, Machiavelli points out, knowing the strength of their bow, set their aim much higher than the place intended, not to reach such height with their arrow, but to be able with the aid of so high an aim to achieve their plan. For there will be deflection, certainly from gravity, perhaps from wind, who knows from what else. And the target itself will probably be moving. Eternal truths have little to do with any of this, beyond the assurance that circumstances will change. Machiavelli knows, as did Augustine, that what makes sense in one situation may not in the next. They differ, though, in that Machiavelli, expecting to go to hell, doesn't attempt to resolve such disparities. Augustine, hoping for heaven, feels personally responsible for them. Despite his afflictions, Machiavelli often sees comedy. Despite his privileges, Augustine carries a tragic burden of guilt. Machiavelli sweats, but not all the time. Augustine never stops. Lightness of being, then, is the ability, if not to find the good in bad things, then at least to remain afloat among them, perhaps to swim or to sail through them, possibly even to take precautions that can keep you dry. It's not to locate logic in misfortunes, or to show that they're for the best because they reflect God's will. That's for Augustine the hedgehog, the ponderous pangloss of his day. 8. Despite these differences, Augustine and Machiavelli agree that wars should be fought, indeed that states should be run, by pre-specifiable procedures. Both know that aspirations aren't capabilities. Both prefer to connect them through checklists, not commandments. But where Augustine, who had a job, could spend years explaining divine rationality, Machiavelli was out of a job and trying to get one. So he had to be clear, brief, and humble. He wrote the prince soon after his release from prison in 1513, his shoulders still sore from his having been dropped at least 6 times by a rope tied to his wrists behind his back. These were among the hardships and dangers to which Machiavelli referred in his dedicatory letter to Lorenzo de' Medici, but he made fun of his torture in his letters to friends. Whistling in darkness was a specialty. Lorenzo probably never read The Prince. He wasn't his age's brightest light bulb. Nor would it have done him much good if he had, because he died in 1519. Machiavelli himself followed in 1527, 5 years before The Prince was published in 1532. By then it was ecumenically notorious. It's said to have justified both the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Counter-Reformation. It made the first papal index of prohibited books in 1559. It inspired sneers in Shakespeare, but sympathy in John Locke and the American Founding Fathers. It created, for better or for worse, the contemporary discipline of political science. And it keeps my own students awake nights. Is this what I'll have to do after I graduate? If Augustine was a great sinner for so small a boy, The Prince is a great shocker, even now, for so small a book. 9. Its most memorable scene takes place in the piazza at Cesena early one morning in 1502, where the local governor, Ramiro de Orco, is found in 2 pieces, with a bloody knife and a block of wood between them. The ferocity of the spectacle, Machiavelli recalls, left the people at once satisfied and stupefied. Cesare Borgia had made Ramiro the governor of Romagna with instructions to pacify the rebellious province. This he did, but so brutally that he'd never have the loyalty of its people. So Borgia didn't just sack his subordinate. He disassembled him and displayed the pieces. The shock and awe accomplished its purpose. At the cost of 1 life, others were saved that would have been lost if a new revolt had broken out. I would not know, Machiavelli concludes of Borgia, how to reproach him. It's easy to assume, but wrong to be certain, that Augustine would have objected. If no parent had ever punished a child, he asks, which of us would not have grown up intolerable? Such benevolent harshness seeks some greater good. The act may be violent, it was for Ramiro, and it can seem so to a child, but it isn't, or shouldn't be, indiscriminate. The principle, for both Augustine and Machiavelli, reflects common sense. If you have to use force, don't destroy what you're trying to preserve. There was thus a gruesome proportionality in Borgia's exhibition of body parts. They came from only a single body. And the idea shows up elsewhere in The Prince. Machiavelli praises rulers who used violence as a means to an end. Examples include Moses, Cyrus, Romulus, and Theseus. But he despises Agathocles of Sicily, who so loved violence that he made it an end in itself. One cannot call it virtue to kill one's citizens, betray one's friends, to be without faith, without mercy, without religion. These modes can enable one to acquire empire, but not glory. The higher glory, Augustine reminds us, is to stay war itself with a word, than to slay men with a sword. But Machiavelli points out how rarely this is possible. For a man who wants to make a profession of good in all regards must come to ruin among so many who are not good. They are indeed many. Augustine admits, which is why good men may have to seek peace by shedding blood. The greater privilege, however, is to avert that calamity which others are under the necessity of producing. Machiavelli agrees, but notes that a prince so infrequently has this privilege that if he wishes to remain in power, He must learn to be able not to be good, and to use this proficiency, or not use it, according to necessity. As fits man's fallen state, Augustine sighs. As befits man.